is welcome everyone to this continuing study of accounting. My name is Business Ethics. My name is Rabbi Jared Anstandig, and I'm one of the rabbis who learn and teach in Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. I want to thank Zeifman's LLP, that's to Steve Roth and Reem Karkulian, for setting up this class. Thank you also to the synagogues, to the Bayit and Shari Shemaim, for partnering with us in this program. I'm going to make another public service announcement to make sure that you put your name in the chat box if you have not yet already. And the source sheet, once again, is right there. As by way of introduction, disclaimer, is that I am not an accountant. I know very little about accounting. I had a roommate in college who was an accounting major, and if you were to ask me when I was in college, what does it mean to be an accountant, it would mean that you do a lot of Microsoft Excel and spreadsheets. That's all I knew about accounting. I've since learned a little bit more, but certainly I'm no expert in accounting, so certainly don't use anything that I say to apply it necessarily for the purposes of accounting. And I'm also, while I know Torah and I know some Jewish law, I'm also not a posek, a halachic decisor. So take everything that I say as this is a form of learning Torah as opposed to anything with actual practical ramification in Jewish law. And that'll be the introduction that I want to give. By all means, it's lunch right now. Feel free to go ahead and eat if you're eating. If you're able to turn your camera on, it's great to see faces. If you're not, it's okay. This is not, no one's going to be, I'm not recording you eating your food, so no worries about that. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts, by all means, feel free to unmute yourself and just say, hey, Rabbi, question. Feel free to put it in the chat box as well. I'm going to put in the chat box one more time the source sheet, and I'm also going to make, again, one more time the comments to make sure that if you have not yet signed in or put your name in the chat box, to please do so to make sure that you get credit for that, for this course. And with that, we'll jump right in. The topic of today is the accountant's fiduciary responsibility. So I have for you in the first source here, taken from the CPA Code of Professional Conduct, from the CPA Ontario's Code of Professional Conduct. And we have here in Rule 202, integrity in due care and objectivity. Right? And they have members and firms have duties to those to whom they provide professional services that arise from the nature of the relationships with the recipients of the services. I'm in source number one on the source sheet. Members and firms have a professional duty to act with integrity and due care, and a contractual duty to provide services as defined by the terms of their engagement or employment. In certain cases, the relationship between a member or firm and those to whom they provide professional services could also be one that the courts describe as a fiduciary relationship that gives rise to fiduciary duties. Right? So what we're seeing here, and this is sort of the springboard that we're gonna come from, is laying out the idea that it is conceivable that an accountant could have a fiduciary responsibility to the person for whom that accountant is working. And even if we're not going to say there's a formal legal fiduciary responsibility, there's still a professional duty to act with integrity and due care, and a contractual duty to provide services as defined, just quoting from that first source. So we see that there is, even if we're not going to say there's a necessarily a legal fiduciary responsibility, there's a general expectation or assumption, requirement, that the accountant acts with integrity, that the accountant has the client's best interests in mind, and the accountant is not working for herself or himself, but they're working on behalf and providing a service for the client. And so when I was thinking about this concept of an accountant and a fiduciary responsibility or an obligation requirement to work with integrity, I'm curious to see how does this play out in the realm of Jewish law, in the realm of halacha. What does Jewish law have to say about this concept, about an accountant, about the idea of if I'm managing someone else's funds and their assets and money, so what does that mean for me? What does Jewish law say about that? So that's where we're going to go right now. That's what we're going to be focusing on. From the realm and the eyes of Jewish law, what is this status of the accountant as far as his or her responsibilities to their client? So before even getting into anywhere, I thought it was worth just noting this source number two is a Sifra. This is a rabbinic teaching. We'll say approximately 2,000 or so years old, maybe a little less than that. But this is an old rabbinic teaching. The old rabbinic teaching says, there's the Torah. The Torah says, Lifnei iver lo titen michshol. Before the blind man, a blind person, do not place a stumbling block. There is a prohibition in the Torah that one is not allowed to place a stumbling block in front of someone who's blind. So the Sifra, this rabbinic tradition, tries to understand, what does that mean? Does that mean I physically can't place a stumbling block in front of someone who's blind? So the Sifra, this rabbinic tradition, says, no. What it means is, do not say to him, do not say to your friend, sell your field and buy a donkey, and you seek to take it from him. Meaning, it is inappropriate for me, and maybe even a violation of the Torah's laws, of the Bible's laws, for me to go up to someone and say, hey, I think you should sell this asset and purchase something else, when my entire motivation is just to gain from that, selfishly motivated, right? This is a very powerful idea that in order for us to, if I'm motivated selfishly, and I want, even though it's going to be mutually beneficial, you're going to, you know, sell your donkey, and you're going to sell your field and acquire a donkey, you're not going to incur any real financial loss. But what I'm doing is I'm encouraging you, convincing you to sell this asset to purchase something else, and I really want to do it for myself. I don't have your best interest in mind. Even if in the end of the day, maybe it is mutually beneficial, this rabbinic teaching is urging caution and saying one could, I'm not going to go on record here as saying that one is definitely, oh, so we're going to get to that. Someone asked, is it okay if you disclose your self-interest? We're going to come to that. Maybe. As far as what this rabbinic teaching is saying, you've got to, if you're selfishly motivated, you could be, I'm not going to say definitely, you could be in violation of this rabbinic teaching of that the Torah prohibits this. That's just something to keep in mind. This could be a very problematic thing to be selfishly motivated like that. Okay, so we have this idea that one has a responsibility towards other people's money. And that's, I think, there's this teaching, is a Mishnah, another ancient rabbinic teaching in source number three, that you have situations where someone could be legally responsible, someone takes upon him or herself a responsibility towards someone else's money. And that's what's laid out here in this third source. There's Mishnah and Shavuot. The Mishnah teaches, these are required to take an oath even when no claim is made against them. So you have a certain person who we enter into business relationship. You don't make any claim against me, and nonetheless, I still have to take an oath. The idea here being that an oath means that I'm telling the truth. We're assuming, even though the rabbis, I don't think, you see from other rabbinic literature, the rabbis know that sometimes people will lie under oath, but the hope is, the assumption is that someone will take an oath. They're not going to be lying. They are going to be taking this very seriously. So there are certain people that have to take the oath. They are partners, business partners, right? Sharecroppers, stewards. This concept of the apotropos, which we're going to come back to, a woman who conducts business with her husband's property, and a member of the household appointed to manage the household's affairs. In any of these cases, if the claimant demands an oath, and the manager says, "What is your claim against me?" and the person responds, "I want you to just take an oath," such a person is required to take an oath. So we see, right, you and I enter into business agreement, even though you have no real claim against me, you just walk up to me and say, you know what, Jared, I want you to take an oath that you haven't pocketed any of our money, you force me to take an oath, even if you have no real claim, right? If you came to me and said, you know, I saw you walking out of the business office with a, you know, briefcase full of cash, then okay, that's one thing. But even if you haven't, even if you have no actual claim, you just want to make sure I have to take an oath, which means that the agent caring for someone else's money really has the lower hand. If I'm a steward for your property, if I'm a member of your household and I'm managing your affairs, you have the upper hand. At any point in time, you can claim, you can force me to take an oath. So there is a limit to that, though, in defense of the person who's managing the funds. And that's in source number four. Source number four is the Babylonian Talmud explaining this Mishnah, explaining this teaching. It asks, are we dealing with fools, that one can force another to take an oath for no reason? Saying the idea, this Mishnah in source number three, does seem to suggest that sort of gratuitously, one person can force the, if you're managing my money, I can force you to take an oath immediately without question, without any thought. The Talmud in source number 4 pulls that back a little bit and says, really, that couldn't possibly be. Rather, this mission, what this, this is what the Mishnah is teaching. These take an oath without a definite claim of wrongdoing, rather with a theoretical claim. And this is what I sort of referenced earlier, that there has to be some grounds. I have to be making some claim against you. It can't just be that I just decide, you know what? I want you to take an oath. It's got to be that I have some reason to say it. I don't have to have grounds for it, but I have to be able to make a claim. I have to say, I want you to swear because, you know, maybe you took the money, pocketed it for a vacation that you're taking. Whatever it is, I have to be able to justify, even if it's only theoretical, I have to have something behind the claim. And this is in practice, the Shulchan Aruch, source number 5, the 16th century major code of Jewish law, rules like this. This is the following take an oath against a theoretical claim. Partners, sharecroppers, apotropos, which we saw earlier, appointed by the court to manage an orphan's assets. This is apotropos, the steward, is someone who's appointed by a court, right, to manage an orphan's assets. And a woman who conducts business in the house or the store, and the member of the household who conducts business on behalf of that owner. For all of these, the rabbis require them to take an oath while holding a sacred object, right? Sort of like the equivalent of swearing on a Bible, right? You have to hold some sort of sacred object, maybe a Torah scroll, something else, against a claim of maybe you stole, or maybe you were not careful in calculations. And none of these will take an oath until they are accused of stealing a finite amount of money. That is to say, that you actually, there has to be an actual claim. There has to be a claim of some finances. Say like, oh, you took $200, you took this. But just say, I think you might have taken something that's not sufficient. But for these, what is sufficient is, I think maybe you might have, that's already enough. If it's another type of business agreement, if it's, let's say, it's not a stewardship, it's something else. So in that case, I can't claim, oh, maybe you took money. It has to be a real, I'm accusing you of having done this. I think you did this. This is my claim against you. But this is a theoretical claim. I could say, maybe you took money. That's already enough. So what we're seeing here is that there is this idea of, right, I am responsible. If we entered into some sort of agreement, I'm a partner, I'm a sharecropper, I'm an apotropos, right, appointed by the court to manage an orphan's assets, all of those people have responsibility that for a little bit of a claim. If the person says, I think maybe you did this wrong, or maybe this, maybe you pocketed the money, you can force an oath. What's worth noting here is that the whole concern is really about, like, embezzlement. The concern here is maybe you took money. Right, the Hebrew language is Shema Gazel Chaveiro Masao Matan. Maybe you stole in some sort of transaction. O Shema Lo Dikdik Becheshbon Shebenei. Or maybe you were not so careful in our calculations against each other. But the idea necessarily of self-dealing, the idea of saying, look, you have all the money that you're supposed to have, and I just sort of helped my own self. That's not a concern, at least at this point in the Shulchan Aruch, in this code of Jewish law. The bigger concern is one of lying, the one of having pocketed the money and lying about that. That's the big concern. A couple people recently got onto the Zoom, so I'm just going to repost the source sheet, and I'm also going to make the general claim again to make sure that you put your name in the chat box in a message to me or to everyone to make sure that you get get credit for this. Okay, so with this as a little bit of a background and understanding, that someone managing someone else's money does have certain responsibilities. And in the event that things go sour, go south, and it's not clear, the person managing the other person's money can be forced to take an oath, which is no small matter. So the question is an accountant in the same boat? What is the role of an accountant? Is an accountant like any of these categories? Is an accountant like something else, someone else? So one thing that an accountant could be like, an accountant could be in the status of, in Jewish law, in the status of a shomer, a guardian, a bailey. But someone who's, I'm entrusting my money with you, and so you just take care of that money. Now, there are many different types of accountants as well, but different accountants do different things. And I know with Zeifman's, you have different accountants doing various different types of accounting work. So this might necessarily apply to everyone. But my first thought was maybe it'd be under the category of a shomer, of a bailee, someone who's holding onto the money. But it's what I thought that maybe wouldn't be the case, because there's a Mishnah, again, this rabbinic teaching in source number 6 on page 2. The Mishnah says, in the case of one who deposits produce with another, right? This is a case of a shomer, a guardian, a bailee. I give you my produce to hold on to. Even if it is lost due to spoilage or vermin, the bailee may not touch it as it is not his. Right? There is the bailee, the shomer, has absolutely no control over what happens to this, to these assets. Even if you had wanted me maybe to take care of them, they're starting to rot. I can't touch them. Even if you incur some loss as a result of my inaction, that's the appropriate thing to do. Alternatively, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, he sells it before the court, as by doing so, he is like returning a lost item to the owner, since through its sale, he prevents the owner from losing the value of his produce. So here, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, well, maybe not. Maybe this shomer, this bailee, does have the right, should sell it, to maintain the assets, the value of these assets, because if he doesn't sell them, they're going to depreciate in value, you're going to lose all of them, and that's not fair to the person. At the very least, you know, I'd have a responsibility to make sure you break even. You gave me these objects, so I can sell them, but I have to sell them in front of a Beit Din. I have to sell them in front of another court. I can't do it in a back room. I can't do it secretly. This has to be out in the open what I'm doing, because we're very skeptical, very wary of what this bailee, of what this shomer, of what this person is doing. So we have to make sure that everything is smooth, is out in the open, and is known. And obviously, I think the fact that it's done in front of the court means that if the court suspects anything, any funny business going on, that maybe there's something that's not appropriate here, the court would interfere and not allow that sale to go through. But that's according to Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. But what I was thinking, though, is that looking at the accountant as a shomer, as a bailee, I wasn't sure that was a fair comparison, because the accountant, in my mind, and many accountants have much more leeway and much more freedom to act and to consult with a person. They can do a lot more than simply trying to maintain the status quo. And, oh, if it's going to depreciate in value, we're going to lose some of the assets. Okay, so we can sell it in front of it. It's an accountant will typically have more freedom to at least advise and do more with the funds, with the assets. And so I wasn't sure that the proper parallel was this bailee, was this shomer. Instead, I thought it was much more similar to that idea of the apotropos, which we saw earlier. The apotropos, which we saw earlier in source number 5, as well as source number 3. The apotropos it's not a Hebrew word. Apotropos is a Greek word. But it's someone who takes care of the funds of someone else. Typically, apotropos is someone. You have orphans who lost their parents. They inherited all these funds, all these assets from their parents. But they're 5 and 10 years old. They're not going to manage those assets. They have no idea what they're doing. So we have the person who manages their funds, manages their assets, as someone called an apotropos. That's what the Talmud refers to them, and even. It's made its way into, I think, in contemporary Hebrew Israeli law. Apotropos is someone who's managing someone else's money, and I believe this is the closest analogy that we have to an accountant. The problem is that all the instances that exist in the Talmud, that exist in early rabbinic literature about this apotropos, this steward of someone else's money, they all refer to children. It's always a situation where there's a child who is incapable of managing his or her own assets. So the apotropos steps in to provide guidance and to actually manage, to buy and sell, invest, whatever it is, on behalf of the child. And in fact, we have this line here in the Talmud, source number 7, the Babylonian Talmud. Someone asked the question, Do I mean an investment advisor is an apotropos? Maybe. Right? An apotropos has apotropos is more than just an advisor. An apotropos has the freedom to actually make the investment. The apotropos doesn't turn to the child and say, you know, I'm watching the stocks and I think it's a proper investment, you know, I don't know, Elon Musk tweeted this, so everyone's buying or selling this, so I think you should do that. No, the Apotropos would just go ahead and make the investment on his own without having to advise anyone. So certainly they could serve as the advisor, but the concept of the Apotropos is that they are empowered to make whatever decisions they believe is right in order to benefit the orphans. And so someone here is saying, John, just think the Apotropos is akin to an estate trustee. It sounds like it. Not knowing much about what an estate trustee is, but knowing what a trustee is, and this is an estate. Yeah, yeah, funds manager, right? This is someone. So we're gonna see. Maybe there is still a reason to say that it's similar to an accountant, or if we are, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe my thought to say that you can compare this to an accountant, or the powers that an accountant has are similar to this Apotropos is. We'll see. But it could be. It could be that it's not an accountant, but. Let's see. What about power of attorney? Yeah. So it sounds like that there's as far as I'm aware, the concept, the institution of power of attorney, I'm not sure anywhere in the Talmud. But I will say that when people talk about in contemporary times, that I was recently actually reading a piece about a child, a contemporary piece of responsa literature. Where a child was consulting his rabbi about, he was never given actual power, legal power of attorney from his father, who is now in a vegetative state in the hospital, and he wanted to know from perspective of Jewish law if he had any ability to do anything, and the responsa literature actually invokes this concept of apotropos. So even if it's not exactly the same thing, it does seem to have some parallel. That the Apotropos has some sort of legal ability to something like potentially a power of attorney. But that we're getting off topic into that. But coming back to this source sheet, the point is that the Talmud in source number 7 says Le'olam, we do not appoint an apotropa for the bearded, right? Which is the Talmud's way of saying an apotropos only. Only has the power to manage the funds of a child, someone who's not bearded. An adult, you can never have this concept of an apotropos, at least a one with capacity. An incapacitated adult would have the same status as a child, but one with capacity would never be allowed to, you would never have this apotropos there. So the Shulchan Aruch, in source number 8, the major code of law, rules like this. But the language is slightly different. A court is not required to set up an apotropos for a mentally fit adult. But there's a gloss. However, if someone wants to serve as an apotropos, we allow him. That is to say that the court is not obligated to find someone. If I say I want to have someone else manage all my funds, I have the right to, if I can find someone who would be willing to do it, sounds like a fund manager, discretionary portfolio manager, could be. Okay. So I could make that, and if I find someone, I can go ahead and find someone. The point is that if you have a very immature adult, let's say, who has reached maturity, the 18, 20-year-old, who's technically an orphan, lost his parents, inherited a significant sum of money, doesn't want to manage it on his own, so goes to the court and says, I want you to find for me an apotropos to help me with this, to manage this. The court has no responsibility to do so. So you could have an apotropos for an adult, it's just the court doesn't have to find someone to do that. And that's the commentary here is source number 9. The Sefer Meirot Einayim, it's a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch on source number 8. He writes, for the court will not be able to find someone to do this. For a person who is willing to serve as an apotropos for orphans, for it is a mitzvah. But for adults, no one will do it. Therefore, the court is not required to find something or someone, for they will not be successful. Meaning, no one's going to want to have this responsibility. No one's ever going to want, I have enough time, I have enough trouble managing my own funds. For me to manage your funds? for me to be involved in your life, for me to have to take care of and be concerned about your assets, no one's going to want to do that. No one's going to want to do that. And so you can't ever, so you can't force someone to do that. But that means, though, is that it's totally understandable that maybe if I were to pay you a certain amount of money to manage, if I were to pay you a certain amount of money to be in charge of my funds here, in charge of my assets here, that's totally acceptable and totally responsible. If you're willing to do it, I could do that. The only thing is that the court can't force me. And so for this reason, I thought that maybe the idea of an accountant, someone who's at least advising, managing, involved in the day-to-day assets of a person or maybe of a company, or could be falling under the category of an accountant. Granted, knowing that accountants can do a lot of different things in a lot of different fields in a lot of different ways, but simply like that, I thought that maybe there's reason to say that. And if that's the case, if we were to categorize an accountant in this apotropos, because I didn't have any other category to put the accountant in, so if we put the accountant in the category of apotropos, so there's what to say about what the rights, what the responsibilities, what Jewish law says about the accountant, if the accountant is an apotropos. And I want to spend the next couple minutes looking at that. If we were to categorize in the eyes of Jewish law that an accountant is an apotropos, because I don't know what else to categorize him as. If we were to categorize him as an apotropos, so what does that mean? What does that mean for the accountant in the eyes of Jewish law? So one question, is there an automatic assumption of good faith? Do we assume that the apotropos is always acting on good faith for the client? And can we assume that that accountant who's managing someone else's funds, do they have to ever look into what he or she is doing? Are they acting appropriately? So there's a Mishnah. The Mishnah says the following: an apotropos who is appointed by the orphan's father takes an oath that he took nothing of theirs for himself. This is what we saw earlier. If the court appointed him, then he does not take an oath. Abba Shaul says it is reversed. So if this apotropos is appointed, right, if the orphan's father, before he passed away, says, I want you to be in charge of my children's funds, this apotropos has to take an oath. But if it was appointed by the court, no need, and Abba Shaul says the reverse. So what's the idea? What is the difference? What is the distinction? What is the reason for this argument? So the Talmud, in source number 11, gives us a little bit more and explains what this is about. It says, an apotropos was appointed by the orphan's father. I'm on source number 11 on page 3. An apotropos who was appointed by the orphan's father takes an oath. What is the reason? If the apotropos had not received some benefit from the father, he would not have agreed to become an apotropos. And he will avoid becoming an apotropos because of the oath. If the court appointed him, then he does not take an oath. He is doing a favor for the court, and if you require him to take an oath, he will refuse to become an apotropos. Meaning, no one's going to want to enter into this agreement, no one's going to agree to be an apotropos, no one's going to agree to take this job if I have to take an oath. Unless there's a reason that I would have done it without. So if I was appointed by the court, I'm doing it as a favor to the court. And if I'm doing you a favor to the court, you can't throw more responsibilities on me. If you make me take an oath, I'm not going to do this. So that's why that opinion says, if it's appointed by the court, no need to take an oath, because if you did require an oath, no one would ever serve as an apotropos. But if I was appointed, I'm good friends, I was good friends with this person, I was good friends with the deceased, of course I'd be happy to be an apotropos. I want to take care of it. I want to take care of his or her children. So then, I'll take an oath because the person would do it anyway. So that's the first opinion. Abba Shaul, the one who says it's reversed, says it's reversed. What is the reason that if the court appointed him, he takes an oath? So since he derives benefit from his appointment, since word spreads about him being trustworthy because the court relies upon him, so we will not avoid becoming an apotropos merely because of the oath. If the orphan's father appointed him as an apotropos, he is not required to take an oath. He is doing a favor. And if you're required to take an oath, he will refuse to become an apotropos. Right? So it's almost the flip. Abba Shaul, the second opinion, says, no, it's the opposite. I get a great reputation. If I'm appointed apotropos by the court, everyone's going to say, look at how trustworthy he is. Look at how great he is. Wow, he was chosen out of everyone to manage. This guy must be a really trustworthy person. And because of that, I feel great. You want me to take an oath? I'll take an oath. It doesn't matter. My, you know, social capital is through the roof. Everyone loves me because I'm so trustworthy. But if I'm appointed by the Father, I don't want to do this. I'm doing it as a favor to the Father, who's no longer living. I'm going to have to do this. No one's going to care. It's not going to mean anything. My reputation is not going to change in any way. And you're going to force me to take an oath? I don't want to take an oath. I don't want to do this. And so that's why Abba Shaul says, oh, he's appointed by the Father. No oath is required. This is a machlokas. This is a debate, a disagreement between these two opinions. Rav Hanan Bar Ami, continuing in source number 11, Rav Hanan Bar Ami says that Shmuel says the halacha is in accordance with the opinion of Abba Shaul. A Abraita teaches, the Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says, both this one and that one take an oath, and the halacha is in accordance with this statement. So we have two different opinions about whether the apotropos would have to take an oath. And so we also have a disagreement in, as far as Jewish laws, and which one the halacha, which one the law follows. In the end, in source number 12, we conclude like this position of Abba Shaul. As he writes, source number 12, when the orphans mature, he gives them their inheritance, and he does not need to provide a financial accounting. Rather, he just tells them, this is what remains of your assets, and takes an oath that he did not steal anything. And he says, okay, this is you had whatever amount of money, I sold it, I invested it, whatever, things didn't work out, this is what you have left. When does this apply? When he is court appointed. But if the apotropos is appointed by the orphan's father or anyone else, he does not require an oath against a theoretical claim. Gloss, there are those who say that since he does not take an oath, he must provide a financial accounting regarding someone appointed by the orphan's father. And this is the practice. Right? Saying that even if this gloss, this additional comment here, even if we're going to say you don't have to take an oath, you still have to provide some documentation. The apotropos still needs to say, this is what I did. The apotropos needs to show his or her work. Right? The idea of saying, you know, carte blanche, you do whatever you want, no one cares. Okay, so when it comes to the oath, we're not going to force him to take an oath in a certain circumstance. But as far as total assumption that you've done no wrong, you've got to show something. If you take an oath, that's enough. If we're not requiring you to take an oath, at the very least, you'd need to provide some sort of documentation that indicates what you did and where all this money went, and everything has to be accounted for. Just to say that if it can't be accounted for, then there's a concern of it being pocketed. But this is all against a theoretical claim, right? This is all at the end of the term of the apotropos, when the orphans mature and the funds go back to the orphans. So then there's a maybe claim, maybe the apotropos did something wrong, so you have to take the oath. That's what the Shulchan Aruch rules, that the very last line, but he is required to take an oath against a definite claim. And make no mistake, if there's a real claim, not just maybe you took money, but there are 10,000 dollars that have gone missing. We don't know where they are. You claim, you know, that they were misinvested, and you can't find that specific receipt. The apotropos claims it was invested somewhere, and we just don't have that particular receipt. I don't know, but I claim no. You stole it. This is not like maybe something happened. We have actually funds that are missing, and we don't know what happened to them. In that case, I mean, there's real reason to suspect that something went wrong. There's an actual claim being offered. Not that maybe you weren't so faithful, but no, there's money missing. You weren't faithful. In that case, then he has to take the oath. He has to take an oath. So what we're seeing here, though, is that regardless, the apotropos never gets off scot-free. But the apotropos never has to just... If they take an oath, he takes an oath. If he doesn't have to take an oath, it doesn't mean that he can do whatever he wants. He still has to provide some sort of accounting, some sort of explanation of what happened. Source number 13, the Shulchan Aruch adds, says, although an apotropos is not required to provide a financial accounting, as was mentioned above, one must still make an accounting with oneself and be very careful regarding the father, capital F, of these orphans who dwells in heaven, a.k.a. even if you're not going to take an oath and you're just going to provide a financial, you're just going to, you know, give a ledger over and say, this is what I did with all the funds, one has to make sure that one's square with oneself. I mean, the apotropos needs to sit down with himself, even if he can't even produce these. He has to make sure. He can't just say, oh, I'm sure everything's there, everything's fine. But this Apotropos was dealing with someone else's money. And if we're dealing with orphans, you're dealing with someone who's already very disenfranchised. And this Apotropos has to be very concerned to make sure that he or she is taking care of everything appropriately. And then there's an additional gloss here. An Apotropos that is appointed by a non-Jewish court also must provide an accounting as is required by law. Again, because I guess the Jewish court is not going to require an oath, but they are going to require some sort of accounting, which means that the Apotropos always has to provide some sort of documentation. To say that everything's all fair game is not acceptable. There always has to be some sort of documentation. And so either it's an oath or it's some sort of documents. And so if I was saying if we were to categorize the accountant under the category of Apotropos, then again, there's an assumption of good faith to some degree that we assume that the Apotropos is doing what he needs to be doing. The accountant's doing what she or he needs to be doing, and they're doing it appropriately. They're not going to be watching over your back to make sure. But at the end of the day, when money is returned, or when we're about to do some sort of transaction, and we're lining up all the funds and assets, you have to make sure that the accountant, as an Apotropos, would have to make sure that everything, all the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, everything is actually where it's supposed to be. We're not going to force an oath, but there has to be some sort of oversight to make sure that whatever happened was correct, and the accountant has to be able to show that. What about negligence? What happens if the accountant is negligent? So an Apotropos, source number 14, an Apotropos, whether appointed by the court or the orphan's father, is exempt from theft or loss. So meaning if I have this in, I put it in a safe deposit box, and the bank is broken into, and all the funds are the funds are stolen, so I'm exempt. However the Apotropos was appointed, I'm exempt because I couldn't have stopped that. There was a theft of the bank. But, chayav b'pshia, but is obligated for negligence. So if I was stupid as an Apotropos, I should have known. This is not like, well, some you never really know. Some investments, they go up, they go down, it's hard to know. If it's something that there's every reason to believe that I should have known what was going to be happening, then I'm responsible as an Apotropos. That's considered gross negligence. That was me putting it in the bank is one thing. Leaving it as a bag of money on my doorstep and just assuming everything's going to be okay, that's gross negligence, and that I would be required to pay back. From my own assets, meaning if I lost $1,000 due to my own negligence, so then I would have to, from my own pocket, pay $1,000 back to the orphans as an Apotropos. So thinking about this in terms of accounting, also the accountant who mismanages funds in some way, who makes a mistake that leads to some loss that's due to negligence. Not due to, I don't know what. I don't know what it could be. But if it's negligence, if you could say that this was me just not doing my job, and that's what led to this loss, so then I'd be obligated to pay out of my own pocket towards that. So that's another aspect of if we line up the accountant with the Apotropos. The last piece, what if the investment was too risky, right? So I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure the answer to that question. At what point negligence starts, right? I think I don't know. It could be that there's like accepted industry standard of what people would consider a risky investment versus a safe investment, like. Investing in stocks and bonds investing in municipal bonds is just inherently takes with it a different level of risk than stocks. And so I think someone, it's easy to say a municipal bond, there absolutely is. What does that mean? What there absolutely is what? What level is considered too risky for your client? Is that what you're saying, Sheldon? That meaning, if my client would say that this is There are standards. Okay. Know your client. Okay, right. So what does that mean? So know your client means I have to know this is someone who's risk averse, and so a risky investment would be negligent because I know this person is risk averse. Know their risk profile. Okay, so there you go. So fine. So then that's it. Okay, good. And so is that a technical term? Know your client. Okay. There you go. Okay, so know your client, right? So that's this idea. So fine. So that would be it. Know your client. If your client is this is something that would be totally acceptable for them, and you lost money from that, then we would not call that pshia because you know your risk profile. I know your risk profile. I know what you can tolerate, what you're willing to tolerate. And okay, this was within that. But it's very clear that you're not willing to tolerate that, and that I did it anyway, and I said, oh, it's gonna be fine. It's gonna be fine. That would be negligence because, I mean, I don't know. These things maybe are put on paper. I'm guessing, right? There's some. It's not this risk profile is not some amorphous concept, but it's like really something tangible that you can point to, that I can point to, and say this was negligence because I made it very clear that I need this or that this is not acceptable, and you did that anyway. Right? Is that true? What I'm saying, that there's something tangible. They're risk questionnaires. Okay. Yeah. So fine. So there's reason to believe if I'm whatever it is that I'm doing, going with this investment, risky investment, right? Know your client, and I can know from the risk questionnaire. And so anything beyond that could be considered negligent. That sounds like a totally understandable thing for me in the case of certainly for the apotropos. So then the question is for the apotropos, when you're dealing with an orphan who doesn't necessarily, they might not have their own risk profile, so I'm not sure what that would be. But if we're going to say that accountant and the apotropos are operating in the same sphere, so maybe that's what it would be. One more piece to add. It's a good question from that. Okay, one more piece is, and someone asked before about what's the story with self-dealing. So the Mishnah Torah, this is Maimonides, 12th century rabbi, major decisor of Jewish law. He says, when a court appoints a guardian and afterwards heard that he was eating, drinking, and making other expenses beyond what he could be expected to, they should suspect that he is using the resources of the orphans. They should remove him from his position and appoint someone else. If, however, so that's, if there's reason to suspect embezzlement, if there's reason to suspect, like, this person is living way beyond her or his means, this is not, there's something going on here. So in that case, they should suspect that he's stealing, and they should remove him immediately. You don't even have to, it seems like, according to Maimonides, in source number 15, you don't even have to really ask any questions. The mere fact that they're living a fancier lifestyle than they should be or that you would expect, you put them in the category of suspicion, and then already you can act on just having that suspicion, which already is the standard that the apotropos is held to. One has to be very, very careful to make sure they don't even give an appearance of impropriety of doing something inappropriate. If, however, the guardian was appointed by the orphan's father, he should not be removed in such a situation. It is possible that he found an ownerless article. Well, Maimonides here is saying, if he's appointed by the father, we're going to assume that maybe he had some, like, you know, windfall from somewhere else. Sort of interesting that Maimonides here is assuming that since he was appointed by the father, he must have a relationship with the father, and the idea that the apotropos would take advantage of his friend's children's and take their money and use it for his own gain, we don't want to assume that. We want to assume the best unless there's reason not to. If he's appointed by the court, who knows what he's doing? But if he's appointed by the father, I guess Maimonides thinks there's more of a reason that he'd still be genuine and honest. Of course, if, however, witnesses come and testify that he is ruining the orphan's estates, he is removed from his position. And the Gaoni and other rabbis agreed that he should be required to take an oath in such situations because he's causing the orphan's loss, right? That there has to be, he has to take an oath to make sure that he was not pocketing the own money, even if, and obviously if he can't take that oath, then he's going to end up having to pay back whatever funds were lost. But all of this is about embezzlement, right? All of this is about I'm taking from you and I'm pocketing it. And I'm using it to buy a fancy car, fancy clothes, whatever it is that Maimonides is talking about. But going back to that earlier question that was asked, the question about, well, what about if it's self-dealing? What if I, you're having everything that you're doing fine, and I'm doing fine. We're all doing fine. It's just I'm putting your money in a place that's beneficial for you, but it's also beneficial for me. Right? So what's the idea behind that? Well, what's the rule with that? So the Beit Yosef, in source number 16, he quotes, the Ra'avad writes, he quotes this rabbi, the Ra'avad, just as an apotropos can give assets to a third party to invest, he can also give them to himself as a business investment. And Ra'avad says, look, we know that if I'm the apotropos managing this orphan's money, and I see that there's a great chance, and it's well within their risk profile, I know my client, this is totally acceptable and totally fitting for me to do. So I'm going to go ahead and invest it in a third party. Everyone agrees that's okay to invest it in a third party. So the rabbi says, if I can invest it in a third party into someone else, so I can invest it in myself, why not? Okay, thank you. Why not? Why not just invest it in myself? Doesn't make a difference. So he says, it's okay. There is no concern, no cause for concern, since he is notifying the court about this. Right? The Beit Yosef says, it's acceptable, it's okay, provided that he is disclosing it to the court. And presumably, the reason that he's disclosing it to the court is that the court can look into it and make sure that this is it's mutually beneficial at the very least, or that it's not going to be detrimental to the orphans. Right? That it's totally fine. Focusing, going to the case that we saw, the very opening case of the person who convinces him, I sell your field so I can buy it. If it's disclosed, if it's hidden, and I'm just saying it secretly, then maybe there's that violation that we started with. But if it's not secret, if it's open, if it's done, it's done in front of the court, and the court, I say, sell this field. You buy the donkey with the money you get from this field, and I'm going to buy your field. I need the field. If it's all explicit, all open, then it's not a problem. Again, because the court can look into it. Meaning, it's the responsibility of the court to make sure that the orphans are being taken care of. But if I'm the apotropos and I believe that this will be mutually beneficial for you and for me, so I can go ahead and do that, and the court's responsibility to make sure that it's okay. So I'm not sure if applying this to the rules of accountant, if we put the accountant in this category of the apotropos, so as far as self-dealing, provided that things are very out in the open, and it's very clear, and it's done in front of the court, or done in the public eye, and I'm not hiding anything, I'm not keeping anything secret, I'm merely saying, this money needs to go, you want to invest this money somewhere, I have this that I'm going to gain from, by all means, as long as that's out in the open and explicit and clear, there shouldn't be any problem with that. The only problem would come when it's more secretive, when giving it to myself looks like maybe I'm not motivated, maybe I don't have your interest in mind, the orphan's interest in mind, or the my client's interest in mind, maybe I'm really interested only in myself, and so that would require a little more care and making sure. So that would be the accountant with that. So to summarize those three pieces, assuming, which is what I was assuming, that the accountant falls under the category of some sort as an apotropos, it would be that regardless of whether the apotropos always has to give an accountability, whether he takes an oath, whether he or she provides financial documents that explain what happened, the apotropos always needs to show his work, always needs to be able to demonstrate what happened, where it happened, and that would be incumbent on the accountant as well to make sure that notes are kept and details are kept and documents are kept so that the client can always be able to see what's going on with the money, what's going on with that. And it's even going back that at any given time, right, we saw that first Mishnah at the beginning, at any given time, in theory, the partner or the orphan, in this case the client, could approach and say, if I have a reason to believe that there's something fishy going on, at any point in time, you'd say, I'm suspicious. You got to show me some documents here because I don't know what you're doing. That's one idea there. The second one about the accountant is negligent. So yeah, now Patroclus, who's negligent, has to pay back from his or her own funds because they were woefully negligent and mismanaged and mishandled the money. So that would be the same about the accountant, going back to know your client and the risk, what the risk questionnaires and what the client is willing to handle. And so you know what's negligent and not for your client. And then finally, the oversight for self-dealing. So it shouldn't be much of a problem as long as the apotropos puts it out in the open that this is beneficial for me and I want this to go to me because I'm going to benefit from it. As long as there's a third party that is a disinterested third party who can genuinely, honestly look at the details and see whether this is going to harm the client, harm the orphans or not, and it's out in the open, and that person sees it, the third party sees it, signs off on it and says, yeah, I see no problem with this, then it shouldn't be a problem for the accountant. It's not a problem for the apotropos, and it should not be a problem for the accountant. And so that's a little bit of if we were to see what the accountant's responsibility are toward the client. Again, this is a huge topic, and there's not a perfect analog in Jewish law to the accountant. But if we assume the category of apotropos, so then I believe that this could be some of the practical ramifications of that. Any questions? Any comments? I'm happy I learned the expression "know your client." That's a big deal for me. But any thoughts or questions or comments on this?